Welcome back to Run the List, a medical education podcast in partnership with McGraw-Hill Medical. Our hosts are Dr. Naveen Kumar, Dr. Walker Redd, Dr. Emily Gutowski, Dr. Joyce Au, and myself, Blake Smith. As a quick disclaimer, this podcast is meant for informational and educational purposes only and should not be understood as medical advice under any circumstances.
Welcome back to Run the List. My name is Emily Gutowski, and I'm here with Dr. Stacy Leisman, Associate Professor of Medicine, Nephrology, and Medical Education at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York, as well as co-director of the pre-clerkship curriculum at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine. In her spare time, she loves to sing. She's also joining us today to discuss renal replacement therapies as part of our nephrology series. So we'll be using a couple different cases today to discuss the differences between various renal replacement therapies, including intermittent HD, peritoneal dialysis, as well as CVVH. Dr. Leisman, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So before we begin, I think it would be useful to go over some of the basics of vocabulary, of some of the terminology that we use to go over dialysis. Dr. Leisman, can you take us through some of these terms?
That sounds great. When we think about dialysis, we think that we have to replace kidney function. And the two pieces of kidney function that we replace with dialysis are the ability to clear toxins, and those can be toxins such as potassium or creatinine, or sometimes medication toxins, and removing fluid. And the way we do that is through the principles of diffusion and the principles of ultrafiltration. So diffusion is the movement of molecules from high concentration to low concentration. And so that is how we clean the blood. In the case of hemodialysis, you run blood through a line. Many of you have seen a dialysis machine, have seen all the blood moving through those lines, and it moves past a bath. And in that bath, we have substances we want to give to the patient, so things like calcium or bicarbonate, and we have very low levels of potassium, so potassium will come out of the blood. And so based on those diffusive properties, substances moving from high concentration to low concentration, we can add to the patient's blood things we want to add and remove toxins, medications, electrolytes that we want to remove. The other big piece is ultrafiltration, which means removing water. And the way that we remove water from a patient is in hemodialysis, we exert a membrane pressure, a transmembrane pressure, and that pushes water out. And we can set the amount that we want to remove, and then the machine calculates the transmembrane pressure required to push that amount of fluid out. So diffusion and ultrafiltration are very important words. For peritoneal dialysis, it's actually quite cool, I think. We use the peritoneal membrane as the membrane through which products will filter. So we instill a bath in the patient's belly, and substances will move from the blood into that bath through the peritoneal membrane. The way that we perform ultrafiltration on patients with PD is we fill that solution with dextrose. And now we create a high osmolar solution that pulls water through osmotic gradients through the peritoneal membrane. And that's how we perform ultrafiltration. So once we know those terms, we are good to go with dialysis.
So now that we have the solid foundation for our vocabulary, let's dive into our first case. We have a 62-year-old man who has a history of hypertension, diabetes, and CKD, and he's presenting to renal clinic for follow-up. For his CKD, he's already taking sodium bicarbonate, sevelamer, and he's just started taking Lokelma daily for his hyperkalemia. Recently, his GFR has been dropping, and he's progressed from CKD 3B to CKD 4. His nephrologist has spoken to him about starting to prepare for dialysis. Dr. Leisman, what types of patients should be considered for outpatient dialysis?
So when we start having conversations with patients about dialysis, we really individualize that discussion. So if this patient has moved from CKD 3B to CKD 4 in a span of a year, that's a patient I want to have a much earlier conversation with than a patient who may have taken 10 years to have that reduction. The rate of GFR decline becomes very important. And now with systems like Epic or other EMRs, you can really chart that progression of their eGFR and see the rate of decline. Once a patient gets to CKD4, which is a GFR between 15 and 30, that's Probably when we may start putting it in the patient's mind, especially a patient in their 60s, in whom we hope has a long life and optimally they will stay at CKD4, but if they don't, we want to consider dialysis. Once they start getting to about 20 to 25 GFR, that's when we may start initiating conversations about modalities. You can find out their preferences. Is this a person who's active and wants to consider home therapies? Is this a person who may not have the ability to do a home therapy because they have problems with their vision or they don't have another caretaker at home who can assist? 20 is also a really important marker because 20 is when you can get on the transplant list. And optimally, when a person's at 20, before they start dialysis, we can start referring them to a transplant center to be evaluated for transplant.
So is there any benefit to initiating dialysis earlier rather than later?
The short answer, no. There was a study done that looked at early versus late in patients just like you're describing. These were patients with CKD5, meaning their EGFR was less than 15. I will put the caveat in this that they used Cockcroft-Gault, not the more typical formulas we use now. But they compared patients who were around age 60, starting between an EGFR of 10 to 14 or 5 to 7. And what they found was there was no mortality benefit in starting earlier. Now, some of those patients never made it to 5 to 7 because they were developing symptoms and needed to be started before they got to 7. They were still considered in the late group. But I think doing very close follow-up as you move into those later stages of kidney failure, keeping a close eye on volume status, keeping a close eye on symptoms, and really starting when that patient needs it rather than looking at a number.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, especially because initiating dialysis is a major life change for these patients, which kind of brings me to my next question. If a patient like this is deciding which modality to go with, in his case, it would probably be intermittent HD versus peritoneal dialysis, what types of considerations might you talk about with them?
There's been a very big push to have more patients do home therapies for a variety of reasons. We live in New York where there's many, many dialysis centers. If you live in a place that's rural or you don't have adequate transportation, home therapy can be life-changing for you because you don't need to rely on transportation or commute long distances. We do home hemo also. So home therapies include home hemo as well as PD. When we talk to the patient, we try to get a sense of their values. Are they a person who is very independent and likes to travel and wants to visit their grandkids somewhere? That patient would be a great PD candidate. When we describe the modalities to them, many haven't heard of PD, but PD can be a way to preserve more independence. There needs to be certain things that you have to have in order to do PD. You need to have adequate space, which can sometimes be a problem here in New York, to store the material and store the equipment. If you've had pets, that can be a problem, although you just have to agree to keep your pets out of your bedroom at night. You have to have good vision, good hand coordination. You have to be able to lift bags unless you have a person in your life who's willing to help you. There's very few true contraindications to PD. They include things like extensive adhesions in the belly, untreated hernias. I recently heard of a case of a patient who wanted PD, but he had a VP shunt, so that would be obviously a contraindication. But for the most part, you know, we like to really work with the patients if PD is the modality they prefer. Intermittent HD can be better for patients who are not interested in learning. Sometimes they feel more comfortable going to a center 3 times a week and have nurses looking at them. Some patients find the center to be very social and PD may be lonely for them and the center is quite social for them. But we do know that PD patients need fewer phosphate binders, their blood pressure is better controlled, they have fewer symptoms each day because many of them will feel quite poor after an intermittent HD session. That doesn't really happen with the PD. So I think symptomatically, patients prefer PD as well.
Sounds like pretty major differences in the patient experience on both sides of these. So our patient decides on HD. He's heard from his friend that it can be a very social place, as you said, and he decides to move forward with that. What would our next steps be?
So in a patient who wants to do HD, intermittent HD, and we're going to assume that we see a decline in the GFR so that we think it's going to probably happen in the next year. We never know, but we think it may happen in the next year. Then we start discussing access. So we know outcomes are better with fistulas and then catheters for a variety of reasons. Infection is a big one, but also catheters cause stenosis in central veins. And when you have stenosis in central veins, then you can have problems with fistulas or catheters later, and it can cause you to run out of access. So we want to send the patient to the vascular surgeon, not necessarily to put the fistula in, because we generally want to wait until about 3 months before we think the patient's going to need dialysis. But the vascular surgeon can help determine, for example, which arm is the fistula likely to go in. If we have a preference, we pick the non-dominant arm. But once we've determined that arm, then we can start doing arm precautions, meaning that patient won't get blood pressures or needle sticks to that arm. And the sooner we know that, the better. At about 3 months out, that's when we want the fistula to be placed. It takes a little bit of time for it to mature. Sometimes they need some interventions for it to mature. But our goal is to start hemodialysis in someone with a working AV fistula. And with planning, that can happen.
Once they actually start doing dialysis, are there any changes you'd have them make to their medications?
So oftentimes they can stop some medications, so that part is nice for patients. We give them bicarbonate in the dialysate, so they usually don't need to take bicarbonate pills. Often they can stop medications like potassium binders, such as Lokelma. Unfortunately for patients, phosphorus doesn't get cleared very well in dialysis. So many, many patients will still need to stay on phosphate binders, which is frustrating. But a lot of blood pressure medicines can be reduced. So if a large component of their hypertension is coming from volume, once we start dialysis, I've seen patients go from 5 blood pressure medications to 0 just with dialysis. So dialysis is hard and it's tough on the patient. So when we have those little victories, oh, you no longer need this blood pressure medicine, we take them and celebrate.
I guess the flip side of that is also that some patients can become hypotensive during dialysis. And I've seen a lot of patients be on Midodrin just before HD, but we actually will get to that a little bit later in the session. Let's say that this patient actually decided on PD instead of HD. What kinds of things would you tell them in terms of next steps?
So for PD, what you would like to do is, again, see a surgeon or an interventionalist early. PD catheters, we like to place about 2 weeks before we anticipate initiation of PD. But you may want to do the consultation earlier, specifically because we can look for things like hernias. And so if you have a hernia, that's not a contraindication, but they would be repaired at the time of PD catheter insertion. And knowing that a little bit early is going to potentially make a difference in how the surgeon plans their operative plan.
Okay, got it. For case two, we have a 48-year-old woman who's admitted to the hospital with rhabdo after running a marathon. Her labs show an AKI likely due to ATN. Her creatinine has risen to 5 from a baseline of 0.8. Her BUN is 150 and her potassium is 6.4 with only minimal improvement after medical interventions. Her urine output has started to decrease and her partner notes that her mental status seems a bit off from her baseline. So Dr. Leisman, this patient sounds like she has several indications for emergent HD. She's got an electrolyte disturbance not responsive to medical management. She has impending volume overload with her oliguria, and sounds like with her altered mental status, she might be also having some uremic symptoms. What might our next steps be inpatient?
So that's a great question. And with rhabdo in particular, volume overload becomes a problem because the treatment for rhabdo starts with lots and lots and lots of fluids to increase the urine output. And sometimes if people aren't paying close attention to the urine output, they end up very positive and then become oliguric. And then we now have to initiate dialysis pretty promptly. So in this patient, optimally, we can get her to consent for the procedure before she becomes so uremic that she can no longer consent. And I like to, you know, looking at her labs, her potassium is 6.4. It's a little difficult to get down. We'd want to do it before it becomes, 7. So We would try to get a temporary dialysis catheter placed in her. So an uncuffed dialysis catheter. It has different names. We call it a Shiley here. And initiate dialysis on her. The first session we do, we tell families and patients, is going to be a gentler dialysis with a BUN of 150. You may be concerned if we do too much clearance, too much diffusion of the urea out into the dialysate and drop it too quickly, then patients can develop something called dialysis disequilibrium syndrome, which can manifest as mental status changes, seizures in some cases. So we do the first dialysis with a very low clearance. And then generally the second day we would do dialysis with more clearance to get the BUN down and hopefully get the potassium abnormalities improved.
Over the coming days, the team's monitoring for evidence of renal recovery. What kinds of things would you recommend that the team kind of look out for in this stage?
So the first thing that comes back before the numbers, before anything else, and this is for patients who are on dialysis and for patients who are in just acute kidney injury or profound acute kidney injury, is the urine output comes back. So the thing I look for most is the urine. And if that means talking to the patient and saying, do you think you were urinating more today? If that means checking with the nurse and looking, you know, in the Foley bag, that is the number one thing that comes back first. So being vigilant about urine output is critical in these patients. The other piece you can look at, which is trickier in a patient on dialysis, is the creatinine. Now, as you know, the creatinine will come down with dialysis. So what do you do if the creatinine goes from 8 to 5? That was probably your dialysis. In the first couple of days, it can be tricky because they're getting dialysis every day. But once you move to more of an intermittent schedule, then what we can do is look at the rate of rise of creatinine. So what that means is if today in the morning it's 8 and then we dialyze you and tomorrow morning it's 5, we say 5 is our baseline and we don't have a reason to dialyze, let's say that day. So then we wait till the next day and now it's 5.1. Well, that creatinine looks like it may be plateauing. So if they don't have an indication and their urine output is picking up, I'll hold off and see what we do the next day. These patients, you have to be very careful checking numbers every day, looking at them closely, checking urine output every day, because our goal is to get these patients off of dialysis as fast as we can. We know that dialysis can cause hypotension, and each hypotensive hit can worsen your chances of recovering kidney function. And these patients have lines, and the faster you can get a line out, the better.
That's really helpful. I know sometimes in the hospital when we have patients who are on dialysis and we're going through the labs, we kind of gloss over the creatinine because it doesn't feel like it matters. But in these cases, especially when you just initiated someone on HD, I guess it's a very good thing to keep an eye on.
It really is. And I would say the place where it a little bit falls apart in the hospital sometimes is with team turnovers, because a new team comes on and they say, oh, this patient's getting 3 times a week dialysis. I guess she's on dialysis. And they stop paying attention to her urine output or stop paying attention to her labs. But if that dialysis was only started 2 weeks ago, we should still be checking. I tell my fellows, if you write patient requires dialysis, please put the first day in. Because if it's 6 months ago, then I'm probably not going to look for renal recovery. But if it was 2 weeks ago, I absolutely will.
So in this patient, unfortunately, she does not have evidence of renal recovery, and so we are starting to think that she may need longer-term HD. What kinds of changes would we make with this in mind?
So I think in a patient like this who had totally normal renal function and has this acute event, I probably wouldn't push for fistula yet. If her creatinine started at 2.5 and then she went into renal failure, she probably doesn't have a lot of reserve, and maybe in a patient like that, I would think, is this person ever going to get to a point where they can be off of dialysis? But with a 0.8, I'm going to be optimistic and give her all the chances she can have to get better. So I would request a tunneled central catheter. Sometimes they're called perm caths, depending on where you are. And to place that, and then we would start thinking about setting her up for outpatient dialysis. And what that looks like is you work with your social worker and they apply to a variety of units and then get placed at a unit. The key, though, I would like to point out is that when you place that patient at a unit, it's critical to speak to the accepting nephrologist there and say this patient has only been on dialysis for 2 weeks with a baseline creatinine of 0.8. In the outpatient setting, you expect every patient to be a chronic dialysis patient, not an acute dialysis patient. And if you don't give that handoff, they may not be looking to see if renal recovery is happening. Sometimes I haven't gotten that feedback, actually. And all of a sudden, a patient will tell me, "Doc, I'm peeing a lot more." And then I'll say, "Wait a second, how long have you been on dialysis for?" And they'll say, "Oh, about a month." And I'll say, "Wait a second, can we stop dialysis?" And those are great days.
Yeah, wow, that must be amazing news for the patient.
For sure.
Okay, so we're going to move on to the last case, which is a discussion about CVVH. So in this case, we have a 67-year-old gentleman who's been in the medical ICU for a couple of weeks. He was initially admitted with septic shock, but his course has been complicated by progressive AKI requiring renal replacement therapy. A trial of intermittent HD is performed, but unfortunately, he becomes profoundly hypotensive during his first session. The team instead decides to try CVVH. So Dr. Liesman, what exactly is CVVH? What's the difference between that and HD?
So CVVH stands for continuous veno-venous hemofiltration. And so you hear the word there, filtration. And what that's telling us is that it works via filtration, not diffusion. So the way that it works is you pull off fluid from a patient, and it's large quantities of fluid that you're pulling off from a patient. And this ultrafiltrate contains all of your electrolytes in whatever concentration they are in your blood. And then you replace it with, it's effectively saline, but it's just a slightly different balance of electrolytes in there than typical normal saline or lactated Ringer's or, your isotonic solution of choice. So clearance with CVVH is much less than with hemodialysis because you're not getting diffusion. So because you're doing ultrafiltration, if your potassium in the blood is high, let's say it's 6 milliequivalents per liter, and you perform CVVH, removing 2 liters per hour, well, in 1 hour, you've only removed 12 milliequivalents of potassium compared to something like hemodialysis, where you're working on diffusion. And so every time, blood and dialysate pass each other, you're removing a lot of potassium because it's diffusing into a bath with no potassium. So the first thing to know about CVVH is that if you have a patient with severe electrolyte abnormalities, it's not your best bet because you can't get the clearance you can get in intermittent hemodialysis. So if I have a patient who really needs clearance, I try to do hemodialysis with pressors so I can get the clearance at least. But assuming this patient doesn't need a ton of clearance, when we do CVVH, it's continuous, so it's 24 hours a day. It's low flows, low amounts of fluid removed. The patients can be set at net even and have no fluid removed, and very, very, very labor intensive. Each of these patients needs their own dedicated nurse. The lines frequently clot because the blood flow is slower and you're pulling fluid out, so you have issues with viscosity sometimes and the blood can clot. So often, if you've taken care of one of these patients in the ICU, you hear the lines clotted again, the CVVH machine clotted again. And your options for anticoagulation include heparin, which in a very sick patient is problematic on its own, or regional citrate, which we don't do at this hospital, but other hospitals do citrate, which has fewer problems because you can reverse it before it goes back into the patient.
Great. So all very important points to keep in mind with CVVH. And just backing up a little and thinking more broadly, what are our overarching goals in a patient who's on CVVH? Would someone who's on that ever be able to go home, for example?
So I think the key thing to keep in mind with CVVH, and keep in mind every single day you have a patient on CVVH, is what are our goals? What are we using this to do? CVVH is not an endpoint. Patients cannot go home on CVVH. Sometimes you can convert them to hemodialysis or peritoneal dialysis, and that's fine. And sometimes you can convert them to nothing, and that's even better. But CVVH in and of itself has to be a bridge to something. If it stops being a bridge to something, then the risks of CVVH outweigh any benefits. The risks of losing blood due to clotting, the risks of line infection or line clotting and then needing a new line in a new location. Those are all real risks. And unless you're getting true benefit from CVVH, meaning your sepsis is improving and you're starting to come off pressors and your blood cultures are starting to clear, you get a liver transplant or a heart transplant and your end organ failure or your multi-organ failure starts to resolve. Unless those things are happening, then there is no longer benefit for CVVH. sometimes we do see patients, for example, who have liver failure, who require CVVH because they can't tolerate hemodialysis, and they are not a candidate for a liver transplant. And those patients probably shouldn't be on CVVH because there's no goal. And it just commits them to a life on CVVH without ever being able to get off. And then it also means a life in the ICU because you can't do CVVH in other places.
So a lot of these conversations can ultimately be very difficult and lead to goals of care types of conversations, it sounds like.
And anybody who's on CVVH should really be, it shouldn't be the nephrologist coming in isolation and ordering CVVH and walking out. It needs to be a conversation with the ICU team. Is the patient improving? Is the patient getting worse? What is our outcome going to be? How are the rest of the parameters? And deciding as a group versus one person making decisions about the heart and one person making decisions about the kidney.
Right. Makes sense.
I will add one thing because sometimes this can be a problem. If a patient with sepsis is on intermittent HD or in renal failure and we haven't started HD yet, and they move to CVVH, a really important point to consider is antibiotic and medication dosing. CVVH is continuous clearance, so some medications will be cleared much more rapidly than they would be in a patient who's on intermittent HD. And you can usually look up on different pharmacy websites or up to date what the dosing is in CVVH, but to not forget that you do need to change the dosing of quite a few medications.
Okay, so we've gone over three really interesting cases and we've learned a lot about different renal replacement therapies. As we come to the end of this episode, Dr. Leisman, is there anything you want to send our listeners home with? Any take-home points or clinical pearls?
Prevention is the key. And we have great medications now that can reduce the rate of kidney decline, the Flozin drugs, the SGLT2 inhibitors. Patients should be on ACE or ARB inhibition and managing blood pressure, managing diabetes. Our goal really should be that no patient needs to go on dialysis, that we can prevent kidney failure and progression. And I think thinking that through, making sure that your patients with risk factors are seen early by a nephrologist or started on the medications that we know work is going to be critical to reducing the overall prevalence of dialysis.
Perfect. Well, Dr. Leisman, thank you so much for joining us on this episode. We've learned so much.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.